This week marks the 100th anniversary of Kansas ratifying the 19th Amendment. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, The Long Road to Women's Suffrage. I'm joined by Dr. Terry Finneman. She teaches journalism at the University of Kansas and is the author of Press Portrayals of Women Politicians, 1870s to 2000. Dr. Finneman, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Kansas was one of the first states to ratify the 19th Amendment on June 16th, 1919. That followed right on the heels of the U.S. Senate passing the 19th Amendment. But I'd like to start our conversation back in the 1800s. Take us back to 1848 and the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York.
Well, we're actually going to go back 8 years earlier. In 1840, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott attended the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. People who were into women's rights were also heavily involved with the anti-slavery movement during this time. And so you have these two women going over to London wanting to participate in this, and they were denied being able to participate due to their gender. And so this was kind of the early seeds putting together that there also needed to be a women's rights movement. And so 8 years later, you have 1848 and the Seneca Falls Convention, where people gathered and they put together a declaration of sentiments declaring that men and women were both equal. And this date in particular is considered to be the official launch of the women's rights movement.
Where did it go from there?
Well, I mean, obviously we had the Civil War start not too long after, which captured our nation's attention for that solid block of time. After the war ends in 1869, you see two different suffrage groups form. One was the National Woman Suffrage Association that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were affiliated with. And then you also had a competing American Woman Suffrage Association forming the same year. So it really shows you the complicated history of the women's rights movement. A lot of people know the name Susan B. Anthony. They think that's really all there is to know. But really, the women's rights movement is a very complicated mixture of feminism, sexism, racism, religion, and fear that makes it very difficult to sum it up in just a few sentences. But these women's organizations form because between 1868 and 1870, you have Congress discussing the 14th and 15th Amendments. And while they were doing this, women were arguing that they should be included in them, that they should also be given the right to vote. However, Congress did not agree to this and only included black men within these amendments. And so this is where you see the women's rights movement really taking off and forming these national organizations to try to push. Some of them wanted Congress at the national level to approve a women's voting rights amendment, and then you had other women who decided to focus on a state-by-state strategy instead.
Why do you think that at the time it seemed more palatable to white men to give African-American men the right to vote rather than their wives and their daughters?
Well, that's a good question. I think that gender norms were strict. No matter what race you were, there were strict gender norms for women of what their expectations were. There was a feeling at the time among some people that this was the hour for black men, that women needed to wait their turn. You had women disagreeing with that. And quite frankly, this is where you see some of the really vicious racism start to come out in this women's rights movement, where women are saying some really negative things about black men getting these rights before white women got them. And this kind of racism continued throughout this movement. And so there is some tension surrounding this 100th anniversary of women having the right to vote. Some people consider it to be simply a white women's celebration because they're very aware that women of color were purposely trying to be left out. And these were incorporated in suffragist strategies and in anti-suffrage strategies. People using racist rhetoric saying that you know, we need to give women the right to vote, but don't worry about black women or immigrant women because there's more than enough white women to counter how they would vote. And then, of course, you had the anti-suffragists saying, we can't give women the right to vote because then we'll give black women and immigrant women the right to vote. So you do have this very racist, problematic rhetoric that is going on during this time, and that continued all the way to the end, and frankly continues today.
You'd mentioned that the seeds of this were planted not in the right to vote itself, but in the whole slavery argument. Talk to me about that, and also how the fight for prohibition and women's involvement in the temperance movement played into the fight for suffrage.
Well, the anti-slavery movement and the prohibition movements really helped women gain political savvy, so to speak. They weren't allowed to participate in the public sphere, the men's sphere of quote-unquote actual politics. Women, of course, during this time were very much seen as being the morality of a family that set like the religious and morals to center their family around this. So their participation in these kinds of causes was considered to be okay because they fell under that umbrella. And so by participating in these movements, you have women learning how to organize, learning how to public speak, learning the basic fundamentals of social movements and how to be effective in them. And so that gave women a lot of training that they could not otherwise get. But yes, the prohibition movement was another reason. There isn't just one reason why it took 72 years for women to get the right to vote nationally from 1848 to 1920. Again, this is a very, very complicated topic, but prohibition was certainly one of them. There was a widespread belief at this time, and women got so involved because there were concerns about the impact that alcohol had on family life, with domestic abuse, with men being the only one who could really work based on norms of the time, and concerns about men spending all of their money down at the bar and then leaving their families helpless without money for the rest of the month. And so you do see a lot of women get involved in this movement. But then, of course, there were great concerns about what would happen if we gave women the right to vote. And you have lobbyists for the alcohol industry and other major lobbyists having great concerns and not wanting women to have this kind of power. So there's all these different dynamics going on.
Again, we're marking the 100th anniversary of Kansas passing the 19th Amendment. I'm visiting with Dr. Terry Finneman of the University of Kansas. Long before the 19th Amendment gave women across the United States the right to vote, women in Kansas and many Western states were already voting. Why was women's suffrage more readily accepted in the newer parts of the U.S.?
So the very first place to give women the right to vote was actually Wyoming Territory. And then you see other Western states like Utah and Colorado get on this bandwagon as well. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them was that the Western states at this time were very proud of how progressive they were, and they wanted to show themselves as being this model of progressive communities that were kind of in this land of utopia, so to speak, in the United States as people were going west, young man, and setting up new communities. And because of how difficult it is to start from scratch, you needed women to be much more involved in helping with communities build them from the ground up than you had happening in the East, which had very established protocol and very strict gender norms at this time. And as you are setting up new governments, new city councils, new school boards, new state constitutions, it's a lot easier to to include these kinds of things when you're building from the ground up than to challenge the status quo into changing. So these are some of the reasons why it was a lot easier in the West to get this done.
You'd mentioned before the split between Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton in one camp and people like Lucy Stone and Harry Blackwell in another. Can you dig a little deeper into that? What exactly was that split, and how did they ultimately come to resolve that?
Well, I mean, you had these women have different priorities. Again, you have the one group that's really focused on getting this national amendment, and then you had the other group thinking that a state-by-state strategy was the better way to go. And so there were different philosophies on the best way to get this done. You also had some women who were convinced that the only thing they should focus on was women getting the right to vote, whereas you had other women thinking, no, we need to broaden this platform to be more so about women's rights in general and add on other things. And so you have these different philosophies. And this played out in the 1800s, but you also see it play out in the 1900s, where you have these generational differences develop among the primary leaders of the suffrage movement in the more liberal wing of the movement, where you have Carrie Chapman Catt, for example, wanting a very much moderate type of strategy. But then you have people like Alice Paul, who are much more liberal, who wanted to incorporate more of the British type of militant tactics that involved picketing and hunger strikes and getting arrested. And it was a much more public display of militancy and demanding rights as opposed to a more moderate approach. And so throughout the entire suffrage movement, you have these women having these very different strategies on how to get things done, and then the tensions that build because of that.
Do you think that tension and that conflict kind of within the movement slowed things down, or did that just make the conversation more robust?
Both. I think that the different camps all had legitimate points of view, but it's an issue that we continue to see with women today, quite frankly, where it's difficult to rally around any particular cause to be able to make change more quickly, which slows down our momentum. And then you also have anti-suffrage movement at this time, which was pretty aggressive, and for a while it did very well. So it wasn't until the 1880s and 1890s that you start to see anti-suffrage organizations form, because until then they didn't really care what was going on in the West. They thought they were just a bunch of hillbillies, and what they did out there really didn't matter to the people in the East. But as these ideas started moving more to the eastern part of the country, you see states like Massachusetts and New York become more alarmed and decide that they need to form actual organizations to counter this movement. And what's interesting is I think a lot of people tend to think of white men being the problem with holding women back, but really these were primarily white women who were running these organizations and arguing against their own right to vote. And so you not only have dissension within the suffrage movement itself, but the opposition was coming from other women, which therefore made it more difficult for men in political positions to know which one to listen to when you have one group of women saying they want these rights and another woman saying they don't want these rights. I did a study on the anti-suffrage movement and the different press strategies that they used, and they used a wide array of strategies to argue why women shouldn't get the vote. Religion, of course, was one of them. And in a time when religion was so dominant, this was an easy argument for them to make that people would buy into, basically saying that God created men and women for very different purposes, that men were designed to be in the public sphere and women very specifically were designed to be in the private sphere. There were also arguments that women simply were not smart enough to be able to vote, arguments that women didn't have time to educate themselves to vote because they were too busy taking care of their husband and their children, so when would they ever have time to educate themselves on issues? You also have some really ridiculous arguments being made, one of which was that there was not enough horses to possibly take both men and women to the polls. What were you going to do? You'd have to have the men ride in the horse and go vote, and then you'd have to bring the horse back, and then the horse would have to go again. And how could that even happen? I mean, it was really ridiculous. And then, you know, we think like misinformation and Facebook memes are new, but let me tell you, Facebook has been around around since before Facebook. And so back in the day, it was using pamphlets, and they would take quotes from notable people like Thomas Jefferson and plunk them on an anti-suffrage pamphlet as, you know, reasoned arguments for why women aren't good enough to vote. So there were a multi-prong of strategies at play here. Other ridiculous ones were, well, how could women possibly go vote? Because what happens if the baby is sick or there's an invalid in the family? Or, you know, I mean, they'd come up with all these doomsday scenarios. Another one argued about urban versus rural women and how women in the city would have an advantage because it would be easier for them to go to vote than women who lived on a farm and would have to travel further to get to a polling location. So they used all these different arguments, which hearing them now, you know, seems a little silly. But at the time, people thought that those were really good arguments to make.
So just to be clear, these are arguments that women were making or that men were making?
That women were making. Against their own right to vote. Yes. There were dozens of anti-suffrage organizations. By 1916, there were 350,000 people across the country involved in this anti-suffrage movement, and these were primarily women.
Were the women that were involved in the pro-suffrage movement, were they a minority among women, or do you think that there was some acceptance that, yeah, this is probably a good thing even if I don't want to go out and pick at the courthouse or I don't want to be particularly involved?
Well, I mean, of course, that changed over time. I mean, back in the 1840s, they, of course, were a very small minority of people who wanted this. It took 72 years before you could convince enough people that this was a legitimate cause. This was introduced into Congress, and it took 41 years after the bill was introduced in Congress before Congress, both chambers of Congress, agreed to pass it. So this was very, very slow going. It's interesting, though. People tend to think that the March on Washington against Donald Trump a few years ago was the first women's March on Washington, and it really wasn't. The first one took place in 1913, and women were marching on the inauguration weekend of Woodrow Wilson, protesting that this president was coming into office who had very wishy-washy stances on suffrage. He didn't tend to give very good answers when he was asked about it while he was campaigning. He kind of blew it off as, you know, states' rights. Women didn't like that. And so you have 5,000 to 7,000 to up, maybe even up to 10,000 people descend on Washington and march in protest during his inauguration weekend. And so that was one of the really key turning points in the suffrage movement. But really, World War One, not enough can be said about how critical World War One was to the women's rights movement in 1917. And that's the year in particular that I studied when I looked at the desperate measures that the anti-suffragists were going to try to cling onto their stance as the suffrage movement was gaining more and more momentum. And of course, it gained that momentum because when you have American men going overseas to fight, you have all these women at home having to go out into the workforce to help support the country and keep it running and help during wartime. And so that really did a number on anti-suffragist arguments that women weren't smart enough, that women had no business in the public sphere. When you see women out there doing the job and getting it done and being perfectly competent. And so World War One was just this major turning point.
We've touched on the role of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, which are names that might be familiar to our listeners, but who are some of the people that were involved in the suffrage movement that we may not be so familiar with?
Well, of course, I mean, there needs to be much more focus on women of color who were very involved in the suffrage movement as well as being involved in different racial issues and trying to create more opportunities and rights for people of color. And so you have people like Ida B. Wells and Mary Church Terrell, who did a lot of work for the suffrage movement. Here in Kansas, we had a couple of notable women as well who were very active. Mamie Dillard is a name of a Kansas woman, as well as Carrie Hughes Clark, who was the mother of Langston Hughes. She wrote for a newspaper, and she encouraged African-American women to seek education and be politically active. And so in addition to that, though, I mean, what's really interesting is, you know, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton get all of the attention, but, I mean, there were thousands and thousands of local women across the country who were involved in grassroots efforts. So even though those two names are the most popular, they by far did not do this themselves. It took millions of women across the country over 72 years to chip away at this, all of these unnamed women. One of the women that I focus on is Jeanette Rankin, who is included in my book, and she was the first woman elected to Congress in 1916, which is another reason why you couldn't really put the genie back in the bottle at that point, because you had a woman serving in Congress at this point. And Jeanette Rankin was very, very active in the suffrage movement, going across the country in New York, in Washington State, in California, in Montana. I mean, this was full-time work for these women to advocate for this. And so one of the things that I've been doing is talking at some newspaper conventions and encouraging people to dig into their local history and find out about these women in the state who worked so hard to give women the rights that they now have today.
One of those women here in Kansas is Susanna Salter, who was elected the first female mayor anywhere in the country in the little town of Argonia, Kansas.
Yeah, it's interesting. So she moved to Kansas with her husband in the early 1880s, and she was nominated for mayor in 1887 on the Prohibition Party ticket, but she was nominated as a joke by local men, and then she actually ended up winning. And so
joke's on you.
Yeah, the joke's on them, basically. And so it's really great that Kansas is able to have that very notable moment, even if it was initially set up for not nice reasons.
What about Clarina Nichols?
Like a lot of the Kansas women who were involved in the suffrage movement here, she was a journalist and involved in journalism and using newspapers at this time as advocacy tools. And so she settled near Lawrence in 1854, and she gave a lot of lectures about equality. And she was associate editor of an anti-slavery newspaper as well. And she really fought for women's property rights and voting in school elections. And some of this information that I'm talking about is on bookmarks that we will have available in Kansas throughout the next year, where we feature six or seven different Kansas suffragists and have some of these fun facts about them. So we're hoping you'll come out to some of our events in the coming year and get some of our bookmarks.
We'll talk about some of those events coming up, but I want to go back to your own research interests. You've written press portrayals of women politicians, and that's your specialty within journalism. In general, how did the press portray the suffrage movement, and particularly the women involved in it?
Well, I've particularly focused on the latter sections of the suffrage movement, and so I'm more familiar with the 1910s leading up to the 1920s. But it was interesting when I was taking a look at press coverage of the anti-suffrage movement, how much they focused on very irrational statements that the anti-suffragists were using that weren't necessarily based on any kinds of facts. So, for example, they quoted the anti-suffragists talking a lot that anybody who was for suffrage was also pro-German and a socialist, and they made accusations that that's the only way that New York had passed women's suffrage is because just the socialists all voted that in. And so there was a lot of fear-mongering that was used at this time to dip in to people's core raw emotions of fear and try to make them very afraid of change and giving women more rights. And so it's interesting because you don't really have much for fact-checking going on by journalists back in this time, although there was a very quick one sentence saying that, you know, this isn't true because when you look at the votes in the New York election, the socialist candidate got fewer votes than the Woman Suffrage Initiative did. But you don't see this kind of fact-checking going on. And you have these anti-suffragists really attacking women for the vote, referring to them as being very, very selfish. And we have this war going on right now. And how dare you be wanting your own rights when we need to be focusing on what's going on abroad? And so it's interesting to see these strategies. Whereas the press, when they were covering the suffragists in this particular instance, they used very reasoned arguments. And it was interesting because they also quoted local and regional women, whereas the anti-suffragist movement, they quoted national women. Now, that may not seem that interesting to people, but think about it. When you hear a national politician talk, this is somebody who you don't really know. You have that distance for them, whereas when somebody local or regional, you tend to put a little bit more credibility to what they're saying. So it's really interesting to think about what sources journalists were using at that time. But then when you take a look at the 1913 March on Washington, which is the other major movement that I've studied, it was really interesting at that time how positive the press coverage was of these women. Mostly, I think, because this was so novel that something like this had not happened before, and it was almost a circus paparazzi type of environment, because you had women marching from like New York to Washington, D.C. to set up like a spectacle for this, like months in advance as they were marching through the winter. And so this was this huge event that the press found fascinating to look into. And so there was much more positive coverage for that. However, one thing that is very notable in press coverage is how little attention was given to race and class. And it certainly would have been very well known to the people of the era that these racist arguments were being made about why women should not be allowed to vote because it would give black women rights. And you really didn't see that play up in the press coverage that I saw. There was really no credibility or defense of these women. Even the suffragists with this parade, there was little mention that the white women were trying to make black women either not participate in the parade or at least be in the very back of the parade. And so that's something that we need to really keep in mind more so today, is how inclusive we're being in our coverage and making sure that all women and all voices are included, because they didn't get that.
Dr. Finneman, you just alluded to not just race, but class. Was this seen as an upper class movement, that these were women of a certain social status that were portraying this, or was this more widespread throughout various social classes?
Well, one of the ways that class comes into play is that you have these upper society women who are very involved in the anti-suffrage movement, actually, because they did not want women of lower classes to have any kind of equality. So, for example, these more upper class women had access to powerful men, whether that was their own husbands or whether that was the high class parties that they went to, where they would mingle with people in positions of power and other politicians. And so through soft power, so to speak, through just the conversations that they would have with access to these powerful people, they knew very well that they had some kind of power as women in this regard. And by having the right to vote be a more democratic process, this would open up government to people who weren't at these fancy, invitation-only parties. And so some of these women did not want to give up the political power they already had and share that, which was disturbing in itself. So
even though that political power did not extend to being able to vote.
Right. Yeah. They still had political, more of a soft kind of political power. They, there were a number of women who believed that, their husbands represented the family and what their choice was, and that's all you need.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I know one of the arguments against giving women the vote was that women would just vote the way their husbands told them to, or the way their fathers told them to if they were unmarried. How did that play into the arguments either for or against giving women the vote?
Well, and that was one of the hundreds, you could say, of reasons why it took so long for women to get the right to vote, is you did have political parties who thought that women were a bunch of robots who thought the same way. And so if you give women the right to vote, you're going to give one advantage to a particular political party, and then story would be over for the other party because women would just all vote the same, and then we'd have one party rule for the end of days. So that was another argument about why women shouldn't be able to vote. So yeah, I mean, you do see that play, and you even still have that happening today. I mean, as recently as the last few presidential elections, I mean, in particular, one that I point out during my book is you had one of the campaigns, the Republican Party, believe that by putting Sarah Palin on the ticket, you would automatically gain all of the Hillary Clinton supporters because Sarah was a woman. And, like, if you take 2 seconds to think that out, I mean, people who support Hillary Clinton or Sarah Palin are not going to just flip-flop and vote for the other person. I mean, they're completely different people with different political philosophies. But that kind of thinking doesn't seem to always come out into play. You know, I kind of make a joke, so to speak, that they think that women are all just like one block of cheese that you can just pass around. And it's just really not true.
It's interesting that you say that, though, because just within the past month, I've seen a Facebook meme that was something to the effect of, if all women were to vote in the next election, they could change the outcome. Which may or may not be true, but that's making the assumption that women vote as a big monolithic block.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly you have seen data in more recent years that you're seeing women have a bit more of a liberal slant than a conservative slant. But there, I mean, as we saw in the last election, there were a lot of women who voted for Donald Trump and not for Hillary Clinton. And so you just can't make any broad assumptions.
Talk to me about differences between this era and the first wave of feminism and how that came to influence the second wave of feminism and perhaps the third wave of feminism.
The terms first and second wave feminism and now third, and some even say there's a fourth wave of feminism, are interesting. And they can be useful terms in the fact that they help situate people in history. And certainly each wave had its own kind of distinct messaging that it was going for. But one of the things that we argue in my study is that they're also kind of problematic terms to use because they tend to set women up against each other. So, for example, the argument is that the third wave formed because they saw that the second wave did not do nearly enough for women of color, for women of different sexualities, right? And so it's set up as this conflict between these two waves, critiquing each other, thinking the other one isn't good enough, the second wave critiquing the third wave for their ways of doing things. And by having this kind of language, it becomes really problematic because it does kind of set up this cat fight type of framing among women when really, when you study these movements more closely, each wave played a role in helping the next wave help form its agenda and move on. And by having more of a cohesive approach to feminism, I think it would make conversations go much easier for this topic rather than always coming at it from a point of tension and setting women of different generations up against each other.
That generational difference, though, I think does play out in terms of people, even of my generation, totally dismissing how hard these women worked to get the right to vote and kind of how shocking it is that we take that for granted.
Yeah, we do. And I mean, part of that, I'm going to put in my typical dig here, has to do with who writes history books. So think about the textbook that you read in K-12. How much of women's history do you remember from that textbook? How much do you think is included in those textbooks today? We tend to hear the same stories over and over again, and we don't tend to hear these kinds of stories. I mean, I'm sure Susan B. Anthony, right? I mean, she's included, of course. But you hear kind of the 5-cent version of history, and you don't get these nuances and the complications and more depth on these issues, which is why this anniversary is so important. And yes, it's a long anniversary. It's a 14-month anniversary from when Congress approved it, approved the 19th Amendment on June 4th until Tennessee became the final state to ratify in August 1920. But we really kind of need this time to get the message out, to educate people about women's history and how important it is, because we don't tend to get that otherwise.
How is this centennial of the 19th Amendment being commemorated here in Kansas and throughout the country?
Well, we are going to have a lot of events in Kansas in the coming year. I served as chairwoman this past year to come up with a number of activities that we will be offering on campus next year. Our official launch will be September 24th at the Dole Institute, where I and some other suffrage historians will be essentially going over a suffrage 101 to get people a little bit acclimated to what this anniversary is all about, and then introducing our schedule of events for the coming year.